This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, Lynn Malcolm here on RN. As you may have heard, I'm leaving the ABC and my role as host on All in the Mind. To mark the past 9 years, we're bringing you a selection of highlight programs until the new All in the Mind host joins you next year. Today, a program from December 2016. The Strange New Science of the Self.
Okay, Lynn, so your left hand is in normal position. You can't actually see your right hand because it's behind the screen. And in front of you, I've put a rubber prosthetic hand. Now, what I'm going to do is show you how malleable your sense of body is. I'm going to start brushing, stroking your right index finger at exactly the same time as the rubber
right
finger.
Now you're feeling
touch on your right hand, but after a minute or so, you'll start to feel...
Oh, that feels very strange. Touch. I'm starting to feel it in that hand.
Okay. You feel that I'm touching you
on
where?
The hand.
On the rubber hand.
Yeah, very strange.
Now, if I get you to quickly close your eyes and point to your index finger with your left hand.
You hit my hand.
And the illusion is actually strong enough that if you threaten or strike this hand, you actually have a genuine physiological response.
That was very strong. My heart's going.
That's right.
Dr. Lee Walsh from Neuroscience Research Australia. He studies how our brain determines our sense of self. And in this classic rubber hand illusion experiment, he's certainly shown me how easily a sense of my own body can be manipulated. And more on that later. Defining the self has obsessed humanity for millennia. And it's a topic which has deeply intrigued journalist Anil Ananthaswamy. He grew up in India, where the major religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, are very much concerned with the philosophical underpinnings of the nature of the self. He then became interested in how this is reflected in neuroscience today.
There are a couple of things that neuroscientists, philosophers wonder a lot about, and these have to do with the kind of unity of experience that we have of being a self. So one is just kind of unity that we feel in the moment. If you think about all the various experiences we are having, whether it's visual, tactile, auditory, all the different perceptions that are arising, they all seem to be experienced by the same entity. So there's a kind of unity to the experience of being someone or something at any given moment, and philosophers call this synchronic unity. It sounds trivial because we all experience that as being the case, but when you try to explain how it might happen neuroscientifically or philosophically, it's a conundrum. And there's also another kind of unity we experience, which is the unity of our existence over time. So when we think back to our earliest memories, and also when we think ahead to some future imagined self, whatever perceptions arise within us when we are either remembering or thinking ahead, again, they seem as if they're happening to the same person or entity. And this is something called diachronic unity. And so these two kinds of unities that we are always experiencing is something that needs to be explained. And it's because we feel this kind of unity, people, philosophers, religions, and others have often posited that there must be something that experiences all of this as something that's happening to itself. So this is part of the reason why people posit the existence of a self. And then neuroscience is taking it on and trying to answer, well, is there really something like the self underlying all our experiences?
Was there ever a moment where you thought that, say, brain scans can actually prove some place in the brain where the self exists?
No, very early on when I was doing the research, it became very clear that there is no one place in the brain that is the domain of the self. I think we have to distinguish a little bit between the self and the sense of self. The sense of self is how we perceive ourselves to be, and that sense of self is definitely not the outcome of any single brain region. I think there are various parts of the brain that are involved in that, and the body is very, very crucial to who we are. So if there's any single message that I got out of doing all that research is that our sense of self is really a very intricate dance between the brain, the body, and the culture that we're part of, the society that we're part of.
In his recent book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Anil Ananthaswamy investigates the latest neuroscience of self by exploring a number of neurological conditions in which people's perceived unity of themselves has been disturbed. It gives a window into the neural processes that may form our sense of self. He started with the case of Graham, who had a deep delusional belief that he was dead. It's called Cotard syndrome.
So Cotard syndrome was a syndrome that was identified by a French psychiatrist called Jules Cotard, and he came up with a set of symptoms that seemed to go together. And the most striking of these symptoms is this delusion that people have that they don't exist or that they're already dead. And Graham definitely was suffering from that. He had tried to commit suicide because of some circumstances in his life at the time. And fortunately, he didn't succeed. But about 3 weeks after that attempt, he developed a very strong delusion that he was brain dead. His neurologist, whom I talked to, tried to reason with him about, he would say, "Look, Graham, you can hear me, you can see me, you can understand me." And Graham would say, "Yes, I can." And so the neurologist would say, "Well, surely that means your brain is alive, your mind is alive." And Graham would say, "Yes, my mind is fine." And then the neurologist would say, "Well, if your mind is fine, that must mean that your brain is fine, because your brain is a large part of your mind." And Graham would say, "No, my mind is fine, but my brain is dead." And it was a very peculiar, particular kind of delusion. And according to the neurologist, Graham would spend time in graveyards because he felt more akin to people who were already dead. And again, thankfully, this is a transient condition for most people. And after treatment, he did get better.
So in some sense, he had lost a sense of self, yet he was still himself, wasn't he?
Yeah, and that's the paradox about Cotard syndrome. And here is somebody very clearly physiologically, biologically alive. There is no disputing that. Yet they, someone suffering from Cotard's will say he or she is dead. It doesn't exist. It's a perception that arises in them, which somehow convinces them that they're not alive. And you can't reason with them about this aspect. It is a very, very convincing delusion for them. It raises a big question about what does it mean in this case, what does it mean to say I don't exist? But in a larger sense, what does it mean to say I exist?
So what clue has that condition given us about what a sense of self is?
What we know now, again, this is small evidence, but nonetheless, what we know now is that there's a network of brain regions that we have that are responsible for internal awareness, awareness of our own body state, awareness of, self-related thoughts. So when you're daydreaming and thinking about yourself, this internal awareness network is really active. And in Graham's case, this internal awareness network, the metabolic activity in this network was really low, almost to the levels that have been seen in patients who are said to be in a condition called unresponsive wakefulness, which is previously, it used to be called the vegetative state. So in some sense, it's suggesting that he was really not feeling himself in terms of his body states or thoughts about himself with the kind of clarity and vividness that we normally associate with being alive and, being a self. And then what seems to have happened is that the speculation is that this lack of awareness of one's own being in some sense, body states, emotions, thoughts about the self, this gave rise to a perception of not existing. And normally when you have a perception arising in yourself about something that doesn't match with reality, you're able to reason yourself out of it. But in Graham's case, there was also lowered metabolic activity in the lateral parts of his frontal lobe, which are known to be involved in rational thinking. So in some sense, his delusional perception could not be shot down by his own rational mind because even that aspect of his brain was showing impaired functioning. So it was like a two-stage process. You have a delusion arising and you're unable to reason yourself out of that delusion.
And another condition that you looked at, which relates very much to one's physical sense of self, is body integrity identity disorder. Mm-hmm. And you spent some time with a man called David. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, so David, when I met him, was a young man in his early to mid-30s, and he had been suffering from this condition called body integrity identity disorder, or BIID, for about 20 years. And this is a very perplexing condition to get one's head around. It's basically a condition in which people feel that some part of their body doesn't belong to them. And if they suffer from this for any length of time, it seems to become very debilitating because they're constantly obsessed by this body part, this seemingly foreign body part that's attached to them. And it takes a lot of energy for them to deal with this alien thing that's ostensibly stuck to them. And David had tried a couple of times to actually self-amputate his leg because he just didn't feel that it was his, and he had been troubled for a long time. He would imagine his life without the leg. He would pretend he didn't have the leg when he was sitting at home. He would kind of tuck his leg underneath him and pretend he didn't have it. And eventually he decided to go for an amputation. And it's something that a lot of people with BIID, again, fortunately, it's not a condition that's very common. We don't know the exact numbers of people because it's not a medically recognized condition, and hence research on it is not very good. Most of the research seems to be being done in Europe and in Australia, actually. He eventually did go for an amputation. And what was paradoxical was that once he had his amputation, he felt like he was complete. And this is something that, again, it's very hard to understand for someone who doesn't suffer from this. And the thing that comes to mind that best explains what might be happening in BIID is to think about the reverse condition, which is, you know, phantom limb syndrome or phantom pain. When people, for some unfortunate reason, have had an amputation, say because of an accident or an infection, a lot of them continue to feel the presence of that limb that has been amputated. And some even feel pain in this non-existent limb. What that's clearly suggesting is that what we perceive to be our body, it's not the physical limb that we perceive, but it's some representation of the physical limb in the brain. And when you have an amputation, the maps of the body in the brain should get reorganized to reflect the actual physical condition. But sometimes it doesn't, and you continue feeling that limb as if it's still there. And this is undisputed. It happens very often in medicine, and it's been well studied. Now, BIID seems to be a kind of a reverse condition where your physical limb is physiologically fine, but for some reason, the map in your brain or the representation of that limb in your brain hasn't developed, or something has gone wrong in that representation. So there's a mismatch between how the brain is representing your own body and the physical body. And what's really interesting, and you know, from the point of view of the sense of self, is that our sense of the bodily self is what's real for us is the representation in the brain. You know, you can have a physical limb that seems to be perfectly fine physiologically, it's healthy, but if the representation in the brain is somehow mismatched, for us the reality is what the brain has mapped, and we'll do everything to preserve the integrity of what the brain is telling us.
Anil Ananthaswamy, author of The Man Who Wasn't There. It's All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, we're exploring the strange new science of self. One practical way of showing how easily manipulated our sense of self is with the rubber hand illusion. As you'll hear, I've experienced it myself. Anil Ananthaswamy.
Yeah, it's a very classic and very simple neuroscience experiment that was done in the late 1990s. You basically sit down with your left hand resting on the table in a relaxed manner, and then you put a rubber hand next to it, which looks lifelike, and then you put a screen between the rubber hand and your real hand, and the screen prevents you from seeing your real hand, and all you can see is the rubber hand on the table in front of you. Now, the experimenter then takes two brushes and starts stroking both the real hand and the rubber hand at exactly the same places on the hands. So synchronously in terms of timing, the exact kind of brush strokes are happening on the real hand and the rubber hand. And the key here is that you're only able to see the rubber hand. You're not able to see your real hand. And within about 2 minutes, about two-thirds of the people will experience something quite extraordinary. And I experienced this myself, and it's quite shocking.
After a minute or so, you'll start to feel...
Oh, that feels very strange. I'm starting to feel it in that hand.
Okay. You feel that I'm touching you...
On the hand.
On the rubber hand.
Yeah. It's very strange.
Now... If I get you to quickly close your eyes and point to your index finger with your left hand. So that's pretty typical as well, where people will actually feel a displacement of their hand and that it's actually where this rubber hand is. And the illusion is actually strong enough that if you threaten or strike this hand, you actually have a genuine physiological response.
That was very strong. My heart.
So before the illusion sets in, you will be feeling the touch on your real hand. But when the illusion sets in, you'll start feeling ownership of the rubber hand as if it's your own. And this makes no sense until you realize that the brain is really trying to make sense of conflicting information. It's basically being fed tactile, the sense of touch is coming from the real hand, but visually it's being told that the touch is happening on the rubber hand.
So what's the next step in this research?
Well, this was the original experiment done in 1998. Since then, quite a bit's been done, some brain imaging and some understanding the conditions of how we can do this. But here at Neura in Sydney, we were actually the first to show that you don't have to do this with touch. You can actually do it with movement, which instead of using the skin, uses the signals from the muscle. If this hand was movable, I could move your finger at the same time as I move the rubber finger, we get the same result. So we were the first to show it's not just touch, but muscle. Beyond that, it's really going to come down to understanding what's going on in the brain. You know, this is a nice trick and it's a lot of fun, but really we want to be able to help patients. And that means understanding the system so that we can help treat patients whose sense of body is actually disrupted.
Dr. Lee Walsh from Neuroscience Research Australia, demonstrating to me the classic rubber hand illusion. Another neurological condition which provides some clues to the formation and sometimes breakdown of our sense of self is the doppelganger effect. Anil Ananthaswamy.
Yeah, the doppelganger is a very intriguing phenomenon. It belongs to a class of phenomena called autoscopic phenomena, which include out-of-body experiences. So in a doppelganger effect, someone who's having this experience will suddenly see a copy of themselves in front or somewhere nearby in physical space. It's obviously an illusion, it's a hallucination, but they will very strongly perceive another and themselves in nearby, and they will actually start feeling as if their sense of being a self, like normally when we think of what we are as a self, we have this sense of being in a body. We occupy a volume of space that is taken up by the physical body. We have a sense of body ownership. We look down at our body and it feels like our own. We also have a sense of perspective that seems to come from, you know, we look out at the world from behind our eyes and we have this sense that anything and everything that we're perceiving is happening to us and not to someone else. There is this kind of first-person perspective on the world. And that's the experience of being in body. And when you have a doppelganger effect, sometimes this sense of body location can shift between the physical real body and the illusory body that you're perceiving. So you will see the world from either where you should be, which is your physical body, or from the location of the illusory body. And this can happen in rapid succession. It's as if the brain is trying to figure out where to locate the self, and it can switch from the location of the physical body to the illusory body and back. And it's very, very disturbing to someone who's experiencing it.
A number of the stories that you tell in your book are really heart-wrenching. Which of the stories really moved you the most?
Oh, I think they all, anytime I got to talk to the people who are suffering, each one of those situations is heartrending in its own right, because, you know, we take the notion of being a person and being a sense of self for granted if everything is working fine. And even the smallest perturbation can be very disturbing and distorting. People with schizophrenia, for instance, they feel as if, you know, they're not the agents of their own actions. They feel their body boundaries are blurred. So this distinction between self and the other starts getting blurred. They have psychosis. They experience a very altered sense of reality. So it can be very debilitating. And even conditions like depersonalization disorder, where people feel estranged from themselves, they don't feel real. Their environment sometimes doesn't feel real to them. All of these conditions, very sad in their own right in terms of how much people suffer from it when it happens. The only condition where one can say that there's not the same kind of suffering is ecstatic epilepsy. As long as the epileptic seizure doesn't become a grand mal seizure and doesn't lead to the loss of consciousness, if it is localized and remains an ecstatic seizure, it's actually quite pleasurable for the person experiencing it. Because if you listen to people talking about how it feels when they're having such a seizure, it has very mystical overtones. They feel a sense of peace and bliss. They feel a sense of certitude, as if everything around them is exactly as it should be. There is a sense of time slowing down, and they experience their environment, their own body, with such vividness. I remember talking to one person who said that when he was having the seizure, he would feel like everything was suddenly in 3D, the colors and all his perception. He was likening it to experiencing something in 3D when until then all you had been seeing was in 2D. I mean, he was just sort of making an analogy, but the point was that everything seems to pop into existence with even more clarity than you're used to. So as long as a seizure doesn't become debilitating, as long as it doesn't become a full-blown grand mal seizure, this is one condition where you can say that the people are not suffering as much. But other than that, any perturbation of the self is actually very disturbing and can be very sad.
So, as you point out, the science of the self is still very new. How far do you think neuroscience has come towards defining the self? And do you believe that it will ever really be possible?
I think it has come a long way. So there's no denying that. And because, you know, it's not that long back, maybe 30, 40 years ago, there were some very eminent scientists who were arguing that the self is something external to the brain and the body. And now we definitely have enough neuroscientific evidence to suggest that many aspects of our sense of self are created by the brain and body in concert. I say the brain, but really it's the brain body together that have to work at creating our sense of self. And so different aspects of our sense of self, like the story that we are, the autobiographical self, or what some philosophers call the narrative self, this story that we have in our heads about who we are, it's very clear that it depends on memory formation, and it's something that gets impacted in Alzheimer's very badly. There are other aspects of our sense of self, for instance, the sense of ownership of our body parts or the sense of being agents of our actions. All of these things, we're beginning to understand how the brain might be working to create these feelings and perceptions, or even the sense of being a bodily self. We talked earlier about how being in body, as opposed to being out of body, being in body is something we normally experience. And that, again, is becoming clear both in the lab in terms of experiments like the rubber hand illusion and other full body illusions that they can do, and also by studying situations in which people have some organic neurological condition that leads to out-of-body experiences or doppelganger effects. We're beginning to understand how the brain might actually create the experience of being in-body. And so it has come a long way. But when it really comes down to it, there is at the heart of this whole debate about whether there is a self or no self, and whether science will ever figure out what the self really is, I think it comes down to this whole experiencing of being an I and the subject of an experience. For instance, if you think of Cotard syndrome, you experience not existing, just as when you don't have Cotard, you have the experience of existing. So there is still an I, there is still something or someone that is experiencing either existence or non-existence. Or if you take BIID and, you know, the experience of owning a limb or not owning a limb, well, there's still an I behind that experience, whether it's, you know, being sure that this hand or this leg is mine versus being sure that this hand or this leg is not mine. Now, who or what is that I? Philosophers call this the subjectivity of experience. So there is a subject of all experiences. And the question is, who or what is that subject and how does that come about? And it's very clear, if you dig down very deep, that this question of being a subject of the subject and the question of the subjectivity of experience is not separate from the question of consciousness. So then we come to this big issue of whether neuroscience is close enough to understanding the nature of consciousness or even defining consciousness in any clear sense. And those are open questions. Most of your listeners will know about the hard problem of consciousness. How does some philosophers believe that there is a hard problem of consciousness, which is this question of explaining how does something that is seemingly immaterial, which is how consciousness feels to us, it doesn't feel material in the same sense like our body does, how does this immaterial thing emerge from something that is material, which is the brain and the body? Of course, there are philosophers who will argue that all of that is also just an illusion. But again, the point there is that that is an unresolved question. So when it comes to talking about the self, I think self and consciousness have to, you know, somewhere be talked about in the same breath, and neuroscience is not quite there yet.
Yes, it's a big challenge, isn't it?
Yes.
So has investigating this science of self changed your sense of self in any way?
Yes and no, in the sense that I think it has served to confirm things that I had already been thinking about because of what I had been reading from, say, Buddhism or some, you know, philosophies that stem from Hinduism and other philosophers, Western and Eastern, who were all kind of talking about this idea that much of our sense of self is something that is constructed by the brain, and it's important for us to see that this is not real in the sense that it's not something that persists after the brain and body are gone, or something that is quite malleable, and it you know, to take it as real and be attached to it can be a source for a lot of suffering, you know, within us. So this is something that I had been thinking about a lot and was quite familiar with. And what the writing of this book has done is it has really hammered home that point from a neuroscientific point of view. And I definitely have a bent of mind that leans more towards science than to anything else. So seeing the evidence for it in the way that this research made me see has really sort of bolstered that point of view, that much of our sense of self, all the various aspects of it, are something that the brain is putting together, brain and body again, are putting together moment by moment for each one of us. Maybe, you know, it is important to see that and observe that and then live our lives accordingly.
Anil Ananthaswamy, journalist and author of The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of Self. Head to the All in the Mind website for further details and to see the video of the rubber hand illusion being demonstrated on me. Go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the links. Thanks to the team, Diane Dean and Marty Peralta. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Thanks for your company. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.